Okay, now you can start the bell for the meditation.
The divine, the eternal, is the Lord of our sacrifice of works and union with him in all our being and consciousness. And in its expressive instruments is the one object of the sacrifice. I'm going to read that again. The divine, the eternal, is the Lord of our sacrifice of works and union with him in all our being and consciousness. And in its expressive instruments is the one object of the sacrifice. The steps of the sacrifice of works must therefore be measured, first, by the growth in our nature of something that brings us nearer to the divine nature, but secondly, also by an experience of the divine, his presence, his manifestation to us, an increasing closeness and union with that presence. But the divine is in his essence infinite, and his manifestation too is multitudinously infinite. If that is so, it is not likely that our true integral perfection in being and in nature can come by one kind of realization alone. It must combine many different strands of divine experience. It cannot be reached by the exclusive pursuit of a single line of identity till that is raised to its absolute. It must harmonize many aspects of the infinite. An integral consciousness with a multiform dynamic experience is essential for the complete transformation of our nature.
There is one fundamental perception indispensable towards an integral knowledge or many-sided experience of this infinite. It is to realize the divine in its essential self and truth, unaltered by forms and phenomena. Otherwise, we are likely to remain caught in the net of appearances, or wander confusedly in a chaotic multitude of cosmic or particular aspects, and if we avoid the confusion, it will be at the price of getting chained to some mental formula or shut up in a limited personal experience. The one secure and all-reconciling truth, which is the very foundation of the universe, is this, that life is the manifestation of an uncreated self and spirit. And the key to life's hidden secret is the true relation of the spirit with its own created existences. There is behind all this life the look of an eternal being upon its multitudinous becomings. There is around and everywhere in it the envelopment and penetration of a manifestation in time, by an unmanifested, timeless eternal. But this knowledge is valueless for yoga if it is only an intellectual and metaphysical notion, void of life and barren of consequence. A mental realization alone cannot be sufficient for the seeker. For what yoga searches after is not truth of thought alone or truth of mind alone, but the dynamic truths of a living and revealing spiritual experience. There must awake in us a constant indwelling and enveloping nearness, a vivid perception, a close feeling and communion, a concrete sense and contact of a true and infinite presence, always and everywhere. That presence must remain with us as a living, pervading reality in which we and all things exist and move and act, and we must feel it always and everywhere, concrete, visible, inhabiting all things. It must be patent to us as their true self, tangible as their imperishable essence, met by us closely as their inmost spirit. to see, to feel, to sense, to contact in every way and not merely to conceive the self and spirit here in all existence, and to feel with the same vividness all existence, all existences in this self and spirit, is a fundamental experience which must englobe all other knowledge.
So I have a question at the beginning of that section, or a little ways into it. The one secure and all reconciling truth, which is the very foundation of the universe, is that this life is the manifestation of an uncreated self and spirit. And the key to life's hidden secret is the true relation of this spirit with its own created existences. Can somebody help me with this? I mean, I assumed it was a created self and spirit. This uncreated came out of the blue at me somehow.
It's uncreated because
I had the same problem.
No, I think it's uncreated because it's beyond time and space. Uncreated, if you think it's creation, I think it's something that is created in time. Before it didn't exist, now it is created, and then it exists. Therefore, you imply automatically, you assume indirectly the notion of time, whereas the spirit, the real self, the Satchit Ananda, is beyond time. So there can be no creation or destruction, at least not in this sense that we mean it in the spatial and temporal way. I don't know if it's this
right. Right. So the self and the spirit itself—they are not created; they are eternal, yeah. And the manifestation is the creation of that. That's how they come together.
I think it helps your explanation, Marco. I'm going to have to think about it though.
This infinite and eternal self of things is an omnipotent reality, one existence everywhere. It is a single unifying presence and not different in different creatures. It can be met, seen, or felt in its completeness in each soul or each form in the universe. For its infinity is spiritual and essential, and not merely a boundlessness in space or an endlessness in time. The infinite can be felt in an infinitesimal atom or in a second of time as convincingly as in the stretch of the eons or the stupendous enormity of the intersolar spaces. The knowledge or experience of it can begin anywhere and express itself through anything. For the divine is in all, and all is the divine.
This fundamental experience will yet begin differently for different natures and take long to develop all the truth that it conceals in its thousand aspects. I see perhaps, or feel in myself, or as myself first, the eternal presence, and afterwards can only extend the vision or sense of this greater self of mine to all creatures. I then see the world in me, or as one with me. I perceive the universe as a scene in my being, the play of its processes as a movement of forms and souls and forces in my cosmic spirit. I meet myself and none else everywhere. Not, be it well noted, with the error of the Asura, the Titan, who lives in his own inordinately magnified shadow, mistakes ego for the self and spirit and tries to impose his fragmented personality as the one dominant existent upon all his surroundings. For having the knowledge, I have already seized this reality that my true self is the non-ego. So always my greater self is felt by me either as an impersonal vastness or an essential person containing yet beyond all personalities, or as both these together. But in any case, whether impersonal or illimitable personal or both together, it is an ego exceeding infinite. If I have sought it out and found it first in the form of it, I call myself rather than in others. It is only because there is an easiest for me, owing to the subjectivity of my consciousness, to find it, to know it at once, and to realize it. But if the narrow instrumental ego does not begin to merge in this self as soon as it is seen, if the smaller external mind constructed I refuses to disappear into that greater permanent uncreated spiritual I, then my realization is either not genuine or radically imperfect. There is somewhere in me an egoistic obstacle. Some part of my nature has opposed a self-regarding and self-preserving denial to the all-swallowing truth of the spirit. I kind of need to stop. So I stuck this, first of all, by this error of the Asura, the Titan who lives in his own inordinately magnified shadow. Not sure what that's referring to. Mistakes ego for the self and spirit, and tries to impose his fragmentary personality as the one dominant existence upon all his surroundings. I suppose it's a kind of metaphor for the ego that we're talking about here. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like the Titan is the one that has gotten a hold of the ego, or that they are united in some way. The Asura.
Well, the Titan and the Asura are the magnification to a much higher degree, like a cosmic degree, or, you know, a very vast degree of ego. It's the ego heightened and magnified and made very powerful. So the powerful forces in mythology that are dark, or in the world, the really powerful forces that are dark are Asura, are often some kind of Marco, you're talking to us?
We can't hear you, Marco.
We can't hear you, Marco.
No. You don't look like you're muted, but we can't hear a thing.
It doesn't, sounds like he's not hearing us either.
Yes.
We can't hear you.
No.
Maybe start over. Leave and come back.
No?
Yes, now we can hear you.
I can hear you, Geoffrey.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I have an old thing. I should buy a new one, but it's all closed for COVID, so I can't.
Well, here you are.
Yeah.
So we didn't hear anything you said for the last sort of, I don't know, 2 minutes.
Ah, okay. No, I was just asking if it's everyone has an idea what the Asura means. Asura.
You didn't hear John Robert speaking because you were speaking at the same time.
Ah, okay, sorry. So, okay, go ahead, John Robert.
You want to do it again, John Robert?
can you please? So I don't know where I stopped.
Yeah, the Asura is the dark force, and it has different levels of power. And the Titan is the similar kind of force. I don't know what the technical difference is between them, but the Titan is a magnification of power in a fragmentary sense, in an egoistic sense. So, I mean, in the great Indian epics, you have a dark force that's fighting the force of light, and the dark forces are the Asuras. They're the ones that rebelled against the divine. If you look at the mythology of it, early in the very early in the manifestation, there were these great powers, and some of them said, "Well, I'm it, I'm the whole thing," and said everything else has to be like me or has to be under my control. And so that's the idea of the Asura. Here he's saying that the error of the Asura, the Titan, who lives in his own inordinately magnified shadow, mistakes the ego for the self and spirit. He says, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about this unity is not the unity or not the grand illusion, really, of the Asura and the Titan. This identification with the divine is not that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then at the end, we had this, skip down a bit, but if the narrow instrumental ego does not begin to merge in the self as soon as it is seen, if the smaller external mind-constructed I refuses to disappear into that greater permanent uncreated spiritual eye. And then we come back to this idea of the uncreated self, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which right. I thought was a nice, closing the loop, as it were, of this idea. So,
the uncreated spiritual eye is a self, I think, no? Which is, in certain senses, a contradiction in terms, because the I, we think of the ego, but here in this case, I think he speaks of the uncreated spiritual I, opposing it to the ego. So it's not the ego. So I think it's the self.
It's the self with a capital S.
Yeah. And yeah, it's easier said than done. But conceptually, I think it's clear.
I really wish you hadn't said that, Marco.
I know.
Is it easier said with a capital S? Than
easier self. Yeah, the ego is an easier self. In fact, it was also. Yeah. What I wanted to say with this was not a joke, but I mean it really, in the sense that conceptually it's clear, no? That's a typical, that's a problem with Sri Aurobindo. For me, he is mentally, conceptually, rationally crystal clear. It's the problem, yes, of course, it comes when it comes to the realization, that's the problem. But people say that he's so difficult to read, but for me, it's difficult to do, not to read. because sometimes it's almost frustrating because this idea of the ego that melts into this universal self. And so, yeah, I have a nice image of that, but yeah.
Exactly. That's why we keep reading. Maybe we get it on the...
Let's go ahead.
In a deeper reality sometime.
Who should read now? You, Andrea?
Andrea, I think. Yeah.
Yes. Somebody called my name.
I said you should read Sir Trent.
Yes, I will. On the other hand, and to some this is an easier way, I may see the divinity first in the world outside me, not in myself, but in others. I meet it there from the beginning as an indwelling and all-containing infinite that is not bound up with all these forms, creatures, and forces which it bears on its surface. Or else I see and feel it as a pure, solitary self and spirit which contains all these powers and existences. And I lose my sense of ego in the silent omnipresence around me. Afterwards, it is this that begins to pervade and possess my instrumental being. And out of it seem to proceed all my impulsions to actions, all my light of thought and speech, all the formations of my consciousness, and all its relations and impacts with other soul forms of this one worldwide existence. I am already no longer this little personal self, but that, with something of itself put forward, which sustains a selected form of its workings in the universe.
There is another basic realization, the most extreme of all, that yet comes sometimes as a first decisive opening or an early turn of the yoga. It is the awakening to an ineffable, high, transcendent, unknowable, above myself and above this world, in which I seem to move, a timeless and spaceless condition or entity, which is at once in some way compelling and convincing to an essential consciousness in me, the one thing that is to it overwhelmingly real. I would like to reread this last sentence. There is another basic realization, the most extreme of all, that yet comes sometimes as the first decisive opening or an early turn of the yoga. It is the awakening to an ineffable, high, transcendent, unknowable, above myself and above this world, in which I seem to move, a timeless and spaceless condition or entity, which is at once, in some way compelling and convincing to an essential consciousness in me, the one thing that is to it overwhelmingly real. This experience is usually accompanied by an equally compelling sense either of the dreamlike or shadowy illusoriness of all things here, or else of their temporary, derivative, and only half-real character. For a time, at least, all around me may seem to be a moving of cinematographic shadow forms or surface figures, and my own action may appear as a fluid formulation from some source ungrasped as yet and perhaps unseizable above or outside me. To remain in this consciousness, to carry out this initiation or follow out this first suggestion of the character of things would be to proceed towards the goal of dissolution of self and world in the unknowable, moksha, nirvana. But this is not the only line of issue. It is possible, on the contrary, for me to wait till through the silence of this timeless, unfelt liberation, I begin to enter into relations with the yet ungrasped source of myself and my actions. Then the void begins to fill. There emerges out of it, or there rushes into it, all the manifold truths of the divine, all the aspects and manifestations and many levels of a dynamic infinite. At first, this experience imposes on the mind and then on all our being an absolute, a fathomless, almost an abysmal peace and silence. Overpowered and subjugated, still liberated from itself, the mind accepts the silence itself as the supreme. But afterwards, the seeker discovers that all is there for him, contained or new made in that silence, or through it descends upon him from a greater concealed transcendent existence. For this transcendent, this absolute, is not a mere peace or signless emptiness. It has its own infinite contents and riches, of which ours are debased and diminished values. If there were not that source of all things, there could be no universe. All powers, all works and activities would be an illusion. All creation and manifestation would be impossible.
These are the three fundamental realizations. So fundamental that to the yogin of the way of knowledge, they seem ultimate, sufficient in themselves, destined to overtop and replace all others. And yet for the integral seeker, whether accorded to him at an early stage suddenly and easily by a miraculous grace, or achieved with difficulty after a long progress and endeavor, they are neither the sole truth nor the full and only clues to the integral truth of the eternal, but rather the unfilled beginning, the vast foundation of a greater divine knowledge. Other realizations there are that are imperatively needed and must be explored to the full limit of their possibilities. And if some of them appear to a first sight to cover only divine aspects that are instrumental to the activity of existence, but not inherent in its essence, yet, when followed to their end through that activity to its everlasting source, it is found that they lead to a disclosure of the divine without which our knowledge of the truth behind things would be left bare and incomplete. These seeming instrumentals are the key to a secret without which the fundamentals themselves would not unveil all their mystery. All the revelatory aspects of the divine must be caught in the wide net of the integral yoga.
Do we want to stop there? It's a break of sections. Just, I don't know if there's any comments.
This was just such a powerful paragraph. Oh my God. It's like the whole... I want to say the argument for the integral yoga is not stopping with the silence that I believe is often experienced as the ultimate. And then, of course, we come out of that into life and then we lose it again. And here he describes how to not stop there, right? And to begin to invite that presence in every aspect of our life and our awareness.
I wanted to comment about these, the first line in that last paragraph that I read, the three fundamental realizations, fundamental to the way of knowledge. And so we just read about them, but the first one was realization of the divine in myself. And if you have a book, the same number of page numbers as mine, it's on page 116. And then the second way is beginning with others. So first, seeing the divinity in the world outside of myself. That's the second way he describes in that paragraph. And then he says there's another basic realization, the most extreme of all. That's the third paragraph. It's on page 117 in my copy, which is awakening directly to the transcendent. And that's the one he described in that long paragraph, a second last paragraph in the section. And then he says, he goes on in that paragraph, that last paragraph, and he says, okay, there's these three realizations, but this is not by no means the whole thing.
We're just beginning. Yeah, I think it would be great to read that whole section again, if we're up for that.
So where we started today, you mean? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm up for that. Shall we change the order of reading so that we don't read the same paragraphs?
Well, if you start now, it's your turn,
okay.
I think.
Yeah.
Then that's different.
Okay. The divine, the eternal, is the Lord of our sacrifice of works and union with him in all our being and consciousness, and in its expressive instruments, is the one object of the sacrifice. The steps of the sacrifice of works must therefore be measured, first by the growth of our nature into something that brings us nearer to the divine nature, but secondly, also by an experience of the divine, his presence, his manifestation to us, an increasing closeness and union with that presence. But the divine is, in his essence, infinite, and his manifestation too is multitudinously infinite. If that is so, it is not likely that our true integral perfection in being and in nature can come by one kind of realization alone. It must combine many different strands of divine experience. It cannot be reached by the exclusive pursuit of a single line of identity till that is raised to its absolute. It must harmonize many aspects of the infinite. An integral consciousness with a multiform dynamic experience is essential for the complete transformation of our nature.
There is one fundamental perception indispensable towards any integral knowledge or many-sided experience of this infinite. It is to realize the divine in its essential self and truth, unaltered by forms and phenomena. Otherwise, we are likely to remain caught in the net of appearances, or wander confusedly in a chaotic multitude of cosmic or particular aspects. And if we avoid this confusion, it will be at the price of getting chained to some mental formula or shut up in a limited personal experience. The one secure and all-reconciling truth, which is the very foundation of the universe, is this: that life is the manifestation of an uncreated self and spirit. And the key to life's hidden secret is the true relation of this spirit with its own created existences. There is behind all this life the look of an eternal being upon its multitudinous becomings. There is around and everywhere in it the envelopment and penetration of a manifestation in time by an unaffected, timeless eternal. But this knowledge is valueless for yoga if it is only an intellectual and metaphysical notion, void of life and barren of consequence. A mental realization alone cannot be sufficient for the seeker. For what yoga searches after is not truth of thought alone or truth of mind alone, but the dynamic truth of a living and revealing spiritual experience. there must awake in us a constant indwelling and enveloping nearness, a vivid perception, a close feeling and communion, a concrete sense and contact of a true and infinite presence always and everywhere. That presence must remain with us as the living, pervading reality in which we and all things exist and move and act. And we must feel it always and everywhere, concrete, visible, inhabiting all things. It must be patent to us as their true self, tangible as their imperishable essence, met by us closely as their inmost spirit. To see, to feel, to sense, to contact in every way, and not merely to conceive this self and spirit here in all existences, and to feel with the same vividness all existences in this self and spirit, is the fundamental experience which must englobe all other knowledge.
This infinite and eternal self of things is an omnipresent reality, one existence everywhere. It is a single unifying presence and not different in different creatures. It can be met, seen, or felt in its completeness in each soul or each form in the universe. For its infinity is spiritual and essential and not merely a boundlessness in space or an endlessness in time. The infinite can be felt in an infinitesimal atom or in a second of time as convincingly as in the stretch of the eons or the stupendous enormity of the intersolar spaces. The knowledge or experience of it can begin anywhere and expresses itself through anything, for the divine is in all and all is the divine.
This fundamental experience we yet begin differently for different natures and take long to develop all the truth that it conceals in its thousand aspects. I see, perhaps, or feel in myself or as myself, first the eternal presence, and afterwards only can extend the vision or sense of this greater self of mine to all creatures. I then see the world in me or as one with me. I perceive the universe as a scene in my being, the play of its processes, as a movement of forms and souls and forces in my cosmic spirit. I meet myself and none else everywhere. Not, be it well noted, with the error of the Asura, the Titan, who lives in his own inordinately magnified shadow, mistakes ego for the self and spirit, and tries to impose his fragmentary personality as the one dominant existence upon all his surroundings. For having the knowledge, I have already seized this reality that my true self is the non-ego. So always my greater self is felt by me either as an impersonal vastness or an essential person containing yet beyond all personalities, or as both of these together. But in any case, whether impersonal or illimitable personal, or both together, it is an ego excluding infinite. If I have sought it out and found it in the form...
John Robert, in my book it says it is an ego exceeding infinite.
What did I say?
Excluding.
Oh, sorry. It is an ego exceeding... Oh, I'll read that sentence again. For having the knowledge, I have already seized this reality that my true self is the non-ego. So always my greater self is felt by me either as an impersonal vastness or an essential person containing yet beyond all personalities, or as both these together. But in any case, whether impersonal or illimitable personal or both together, it is an ego exceeding infinite. If I have sought it out and found it first in the form of it I call myself rather than in others, it is only because there it is easiest for me, owing to the subjectivity of my consciousness, to find it, to know it at once and to realize it. But if the narrow instrumental ego does not begin to merge in the self as soon as it is seen, if the smaller external mind-constructed I refuses to disappear into that greater permanent uncreated spiritual I, then my realization is either not genuine or radically imperfect. There is somewhere in me an egoistic obstacle. Some part of my nature has opposed a self-regarding and self-preserving denial to the all-swallowing truth of the spirit.
On the other hand, and to some, this is an easier way. I may see the divinity first in the world outside me, not in myself, but in others. I meet it there from the beginning as an indwelling and all-containing infinite that is not bound up with these forms, creatures, and forces which it bears on its surface. Or else I see and feel it as a pure solitary self and spirit, which contains all these powers and existences. And I lose my sense of self in this silent omnipresence around me. Afterwards, it is this that begins to pervade and possess my instrumental being, and out of it seem to proceed all my impulsions to action, all my light of thought and speech, all the formations of my consciousness, and all its relations and impacts with other soul forms of this one worldwide existence. I am already no longer this little personal self, but that which something of itself put forward, which sustains a selected form of its workings in the universe.
There is another basic realization, the most extreme of all, that comes sometimes as the first decisive opening or an early turn of the yoga. It is the awakening to an ineffable, high, transcendent, unknowable, above myself and above this world in which I seem to move, a timeless and spaceless condition or entity, which is at once in some way compelling and convincing to an essential consciousness in me, the one thing that is to it overwhelmingly real. This experience is usually accompanied by an equally compelling sense, either of the dreamlike or shadowy illusoriness of all things here, or else of their temporary, derivative, and only half-real character. For a time, at least, all around me may seem to be a moving of cinematographic shadow forms or surface figures, and my own action may appear as a fluid formulation from some source ungrasped as yet, and perhaps unseizable above or outside me. To remain in this consciousness, to carry out this initiation or follow out this first suggestion of the character of things, would be to proceed towards the goal of dissolution of self and world in the unknowable. Moksha, nirvana. But this is not the only line of issue. It is possible, on the contrary, for me to wait till through the silence of this timeless, unfilled liberation, I begin to enter into relations with that yet ungrasped source of myself and my actions. Then the void begins to fill. there emerges out of it, or there rushes into it, all the manifold truth of the divine, all the aspects and manifestations and many levels of a dynamic infinite. At first, this experience imposes on the mind and then on all our being an absolute, a fathomless, almost an abysmal peace and silence. Overpowered and subjugated, stilled, liberated from itself, the mind accepts the silence itself as the supreme. But afterwards, the seeker discovers that all is there for him contained or new made in that silence, or through it descends upon him from a greater concealed transcendent existence. For this transcendent, this absolute, is not a mere piece of signless emptiness. It has its own infinite content and riches of which ours are debased and diminished values. If there were not that source of all things, there could be no universe. All powers, all works and activities would be an illusion. All creation and manifestation would be impossible.
These are the three fundamental realizations, so fundamental that to the yogin of the way of knowledge, they seem ultimate, sufficient in themselves, destined to overtop and replace all others. And yet, for the integral seeker, whether accorded to him at any early stage, suddenly and easily by a miraculous grace, or achieved with difficulty after long progress and endeavor, they are neither the sole truths nor the full and only clues to the integral truths of the eternal, but rather the unfilled beginning, the vast foundation of a greater divine knowledge. Other realizations that are imperatively needed and must be explored to the full limit of their possibilities. And if some of them appear to a first sight to cover only divine aspects that are instrumental to the activity of existence, but not inherent in its essence, yet when followed to their and through that activity to its everlasting source, it is found that they lead to a disclosure of the divine, without which our knowledge of the truths behind things would be left bare and incomplete. These seeming instrumentals are the key to a secret without which the fundamentals themselves would not unveil all their mystery. All the revelatory aspects of the divine must be caught in the wide net of the integral yoga.
Before we go on, I'd like to point out the paragraph that Andrea read about the realization of the transcendent and the silence that appears in the mind, so that it seems like that's all it is. Sri Aurobindo had that experience with a yogi when he was first interested in taking up yoga for the liberation of India. He had that experience with the yogi whose name was Leli. And he realized that complete silence in 3 days. So he and this yogi, they housed them, they got in a closet together or something. And the yogi told him what to do. And in 3 days, his mind was absolutely silent, but he was still a politician. And he had a talk that he had to give, he was working on the liberation of India. And he said to this yogi, "What am I going to do? I don't have anything to say. My mind is completely silent." And so what he describes here is how all that's inside there, everything is inside the silence, and if you wait, it will come forth. That's the yogi told him to do that, to go and stand in front of this, you know, these thousands of people he was talking to, and listen inside and wait. And that's when one of his greatest political speeches happened. So he's speaking very much, all of this is his personal experience, but that's one he's described to us vividly.
So there are a few sentences where I am still stumbling. Not that I get everything else, but so the page before that, where you just read, there is somewhere in me an egoistic obstacle. Some part of my nature has opposed a self-regarding and self-preserving denial to the all-swallowing truth of the spirit. It sounds like a contradiction in terms, because the part of my nature is opposing the all-swallowing spirit, but it says, has opposed a self-regarding and self-preserving denial. I'm very confused about that. It seems.
The opposition is between the denial of the small self and the all-swallowing truth of the greater self.
Some part of my nature has opposed.
In other words, it's set up in opposition.
A self-regarding and self-preserving denial. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And then the next paragraph, also the last sentence, I am already no longer this little personal self, but that with something of itself put forward, which sustains a selected form of its workings in the universe. I'm lost.
So after this realization starts to set in, the loss of ego, from that point on, I am really no longer this little personal self, but that, capital T, mm-hmm. instead of the little self, I'm that. Mm-hmm. And but not the whole of that, that with something of itself, something of that put forward, which sustains a selected form of its working.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, gotcha. Thank you.
Sure.
I actually thought when I heard that sentence, when you read that sentence, I thought this is Andrea pure all the way through in that sentence. yeah. So anyway.
Well, thank you very much. So this is very intense. This is very compact for me. I don't think that I can handle more, frankly.
I agree. I think this is enough for me today as well.
It's very intense every time, isn't it, when we read?
It's
so powerful.
So compact.
Mm-hmm. Sri Aurobindo doesn't waste words.
No, waste not, but there's still a lot of words.
Yep.
Yeah. And because every sentence would need, in principle, a comment, a reflection, questions and answers. And it would have been very interesting, perhaps the next time I will, if you're interested, to bring up where Sri Aurobindo describes his experience that John Robert described with his guru Lele, and where he describes, it's really powerful how he describes this experience of Nirvana, where he has this perception of all the world as an illusion, as a cinematographic shadow, and so. And he describes this even deeper than that. Maybe next time I can bring this up. I think it's in the Letters of Yoga or something like that. And Well, we had our power doses, biweekly power doses, huh? Overdoses. That's great.
So we just do a longer meditation, maybe?
Yeah.
Sure.
Good idea.
Okay. Ready?
Namaste. Bye, everyone.
Okay.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.